Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Before we get to the latest news from the State House, I wanted to start with some news related to Central Ohio's Somali community. Columbus is home to the second largest community of Somali residents behind Minnesota. And President Trump made headlines last week for his offensive comments about Somalis, calling them garbage and criminals. Joining us to discuss the local reaction to the president's comments, we have WOSU News reporter Ali Vugrinzik. Welcome, Ali.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Can you fill us in on some background here? What prompted President Trump to make the comments he made?
Yeah, so he made these comments on Tuesday at the end of a very long cabinet meeting, and he was actually responding to a question about Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and he sort of pivoted to talking about the Somali community. He was talking about how they ripped off Minnesota for billions of dollars and they contribute nothing. Those are his comments. He was referencing allegations that some Somali residents in Minnesota had lied to the state to get reimbursements for Medicaid and housing and other things during the pandemic. And federal prosecutors have actually charged people in that instance. It's a big fraud case. They say it's millions of dollars that were charged, but we're talking about maybe like 60 people in this Minnesota community of 80,000 Somali residents or people of Somali descent. Mm-hmm. And we also know that Trump has not gotten along with U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar, who is a Democrat from Minnesota, who is a Somali refugee and now a U.S. citizen. Mm. So that's sort of the storm that led up to the comments. How we exactly got there from the question is not clear.
Mm. So to get some reaction, Columbus Democratic State Representative Ismail Muhammad is Somali American, and he spoke to you last week. Here are some highlights from what he told you.
Referring to an entire community as garbage is, you know, just as low as you can get, honestly. You can imagine, you know, the level of scare and concern that brings to a community that doesn't quite have the ability to fight back to the same degree. We're really appealing to the overall communities, every community, honestly, and for them to understand that, you know, if you stay quiet when a community is being targeted, I think it's not going to be too long before you are the, you know, the recipient of the hate and bigotry.
Ali, did the representative seem surprised by the president's comments?
He didn't strike me as surprised. Mm-hmm. You can hear in his tone of voice that he's doesn't seem shocked in any way. Mm-hmm. And he talked a lot about how in Trump's first administration and even more so now in the second one, we've heard a lot of comments like this from him, not necessarily targeting the Somali community specifically, but just in general about certain groups of people that the president seems to not like. So I would say he wasn't surprised at all.
Mm. The lawmaker said he and other elected officials want residents to know that the Somali community contributes to society, should be respected. What did he want people of Columbus to know about Columbus's Somali population?
Pretty much just what you said there. He really wanted everyone in Columbus to realize that these are their neighbors. They are local business owners. They're people you pass on the street. And he also really talked about how, you know, if you don't speak up when this community is targeted, what's going to happen when your community is targeted? And he also gave the number of about 10,000 Somali American business owners in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And Mayor Ginther later said that about 500 of those business owners are right here in Columbus. Mm. Or sorry, 500.
Yeah. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with WOSU reporter Ali Vugrinzik about recent comments the president made about people from Somalia. So the city held a press conference over the weekend. It was on Saturday. What do you know about who attended, who was there, why they decided to have this Saturday press conference?
Yeah, it was a press conference, but it was sort of branded as a community gathering. And we saw maybe 9 state representatives, a state senator, the mayor was there, about half of Columbus City Council, and at least one Columbus City Schools board member. And basically, they wanted to come together and, quote, reaffirm their support for the Somali American community here in Central Ohio because they say they have always supported them.
Did it seem like a lot of people from the Somali American community came to like watch, or was it just it was cold, so maybe not? I don't know.
I was watching this on live stream. Mm-hmm. I was at home in my pajamas, admittedly, right. But it looked like there were quite a few people there. Mm-hmm. And it looked like sort of a mix of community leaders and the members of the Somali American community as well. Mm-hmm. Representatives Ismail Mohammed and Munira Abdulali both spoke. Mm-hmm. They're both Somali Americans elected to our state legislature.
And they represent parts of Columbus. They're from around here.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. They're local. And Mohammed, Rep. Mohammed, says that he represents the largest Somali American population in Ohio in his district. So we heard from both of them. Representative Abdulali called Trump's comments shameful. Mm-hmm. And we also heard from some just local leaders as well in the Somali and Muslim communities.
Last week, our colleague Kenny Genius interviewed Columbus City Council President Shannon Hardin. It's about comments that he made on social media related to Columbus's Somali community. Here's what he had to say last week.
We're talking about people you know. This is not abstract. We are talking about people that you know who are living day to day in real fear. And I just think that we should put ourselves in their shoes and do whatever we can to make sure that they know that they are a part of an integral part of our community.
So what do we know about the Somali population in Columbus? Do you have numbers, Allie?
Yeah, the numbers are sort of fuzzy. We've heard as low as 45,000 and as high as 60,000. Mm-hmm. The number that Mayor Ginther gave was 60,000 people. And I already quoted you those numbers of the folks who are involved in business here in Central Ohio. We are the second largest community after that Minneapolis-St. Paul area community of Somali Americans.
And Katie Genius talked to Shannon Hardin basically because he wrote on social media that, what did he say? A friend of his was just very scared about walking around.
Yes, he said that he had a friend that was carrying around his passport because he was afraid that Immigration and Customs would, you know, come up to him and wouldn't acknowledge that he was legally, you know, supposed to be here. So he's carrying around his passport. Shannon Hardin also wrote on social media that he, you know, the city of Columbus rejects Trump's racist nonsense, except he didn't use the word nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so basically people like Shannon Hardin and then Mayor Ginther, they had this event on Saturday because they wanted the Somali community to know that they're supported. They disagree with the president, basically.
That was basically the impetus behind all of this. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who spoke was also Khalid Tehrani with the Council on American Islamic Relations. And he said that next Saturday is actually going to be a day of action in support of the Somali community. But we don't really know what's planned for that yet. Mm-hmm. So we'll see exactly what that means.
OK. There was also immigration related news that you covered last week. It was a busy week.
Very busy.
Many Central Ohio refugees will see delays in their immigration process. And that includes people from Somalia, also Haiti, Afghanistan. There's about a dozen other countries on the list. And you spoke with Angie Plummer, who is the director of the Community Refugee and Immigration Services, also known as CRIS, who called this a significant delay. In your interview, Plummer also said this.
It's terrible. I've like run out of adjectives and it's hard to know how it will play out.
Even in that short clip, she sounds a little beleaguered. What was it like talking to Angie Plummer?
I would say that she was distressed. These are people that she works with closely. A lot of them are friends, people she knows personally. And one of the things she emphasized is, you know, these are just people. She said something to the effect of, you know, all these immigrants are people. There are some of them I'm very close with. There are some I wouldn't invite to Sunday dinner, but they still deserve to be treated with respect. So we were talking on Tuesday. Tuesday was a big day, or I think we were talking on Wednesday about Tuesday. She received a memo from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Citizen and Immigration Services that basically put all asylum decisions on hold. Mm. And that was after Homeland Security had already froze permanent residence or green card applications for folks from these 19 countries who are on a travel ban list from earlier in the year. You listed some of the countries. So basically, it sort of just pauses everything that was happening. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's going on with these people from these countries is that the administration wants to reinterview a lot of them and potentially revoke benefits that have already been bestowed on them, or prevent them from moving forward in the process.
Mm. Now, is this related, this decision about immigration, is this related directly to, or is the timing related, I guess is how I should ask it, related to it being a person from Afghanistan who is the one who's accused of shooting the two National Guard members in D.C.? Is that where this came from?
It's hard to say for certain, but that memo did reference that. So mm-hmm. I would say there's certainly a correlation, or they're using that incident as a reason to advance mm-hmm. these sort of decisions. Whether they were in the works before that, I don't know.
Yeah. Do you know how many people Chris helped to settle in Central Ohio over the past year? Like, in maybe you probably have numbers from 2024.
2024 was about 1,000 people mm-hmm. that they settled here in Central Ohio, and all of those people would have pending green card applications at this mm-hmm. point that are now on hold. Mm-hmm. You could apply for a green card a year after you settle somewhere, I believe.
Okay. So, and this idea of a green card being on hold, even though they're going through the whole becoming legal process, what, when people have a green card, like, what benefits come with that? Like, why do you want one, basically?
There are things like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance mm-hmm. Program that we've heard a lot about recently. You can get on that with a green card. Another big thing is travel. Mm-hmm. It's hard to come and go without a green card. Mm. So there are families who are separated. One example Angie Plummer gave was there is a family who the wife is here and the husband is in Canada, and they can't visit each other because there have been these delays in the green card process, and they can't legally move around without potentially not being able to come back.
Mm, I see. All right. Well, we have been talking about Central Ohio Somali community in the wake of President Trump's comments about their home country. And we've been talking with WOSU News reporter Allie Vugrinczyk. Thank you for your time today, Allie.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
And coming up, we have two State House reporters joining us to talk about some of the latest bills that are moving through the State House and on Governor DeWine's desk, and one of which he recently vetoed. That's when All Sides continues with the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from the Ohio History Connection. Ohio's history is rich with stories, and with assistance, it can be protected. Supporting the Ohio History Connection today can help ensure that future generations experience the moments, people, and places that shaped Ohio. Learn more at ohiohistory.org/giving.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And joining us now to tell us about some things happening at the State House, we have reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Megan Henry. Thanks for being here, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And shortly, we'll have reporter from Signal Ohio, Jake Zuckerman, joining us. But right now, we'll start with Governor DeWine exercised his veto power last week on a bill that would have allowed 14 and 15-year-olds to work to 9 p.m. on school nights. Here is what the governor said last month when he was commenting about the bill. This is before it reached his desk.
Well, look, I mean, you want kids to be able to work. I mean, part of growing up is being able to work. But there are also some downsides to having kids working up to 9 o'clock at night.
All right. So, Megan, the governor released a statement when he vetoed this bill. What did he say about it? Why didn't he not want this to become law?
Yeah, basically, he was saying that he believes it's unwise to allow 14 and 15-year-olds to work until 9 p.m. The law allows them to work until 7 p.m. So he really emphasized that the idea that they can work two additional hours on school nights, was all in caps in his veto message, mm-hmm. Really was concerning for him. And so he wants to keep the law the same, not change it. That way, teenagers in that age range, 14, 15-year-olds, can balance working and also studying for school.
So basically, this passed both the House and the Senate, though. So all the lawmakers wanted this, except those who voted against it, I guess.
Yes, there is this bill is veto-proof. Mm-hmm. Lawmakers would need a 3/5 vote from each chamber to override the veto, and they do have those numbers. A lot of Democrats, not all Democrats, but most Democrats voted against it. Some Republicans in the House voted against it. I believe all the Ohio Senate Republicans voted for it. But yeah, this bill could very well be has the potential to be overridden. The Senate has session tomorrow, and that will be the last meeting before the new year. So we'll see. It would have to originate. The veto would have to originate in the Senate since it is a Senate bill. So curious to see if that'll come up at all tomorrow.
Interesting. I wonder if they were surprised that Governor DeWine vetoed it. I mean, he made comments about not liking it. So,
yeah, I don't think it was that much of a surprise since DeWine loves the children and does a lot of policy work around children and the well-being of them. So I don't think it was like a total surprise, but we'll see.
What did backers of the bill say? Like, why did they want kids to be able to work later on school nights?
They were saying it would help, you know, meet the need of in-demand jobs. And some lawmakers who worked when they were teenagers themselves were speaking on the floor of the chamber saying how, you know, working in high school really helped them with their work ethic and having responsibility and being able to contribute to the family income.
Mm. But there's also this matter of the federal law, right? That would have to change, right, for this to happen.
Correct. Yeah. So that's kind of an interesting like wrinkle to it. There is the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. So there would require the federal government making changes to that. Now, the Ohio lawmakers separately passed a Senate resolution, which essentially urges Congress to make these changes, but it doesn't make the changes on its own.
So would Ohio's bill not matter if the federal law says that 14 to 15 year olds can't work till 9 p.m.?
That is kind of the question. That's kind of, uncertain until it actually comes to fruition. But that does seem to be an added wrinkle in all of this.
Okay. Is anyone at the state level really checking on whether a teenager is working later than 7 p.m.? Like, is there, like, how do you know that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there were some reports of, you know, anecdotally of some teenagers already, and 14, 15 year olds already working until 9 p.m. So I'm not entirely sure how that is being necessarily like monitored or tracked. 14, 15 year olds can work until 9 p.m. during a school break, such as summer, or we have winter break coming up. It's just purely on the school nights.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess an employer wouldn't want to be breaking the law by having them there past 7 p.m. But if it's like 7:10, I don't think that there's like a state lawmaker standing at the door knocking on the window being like, you need to go home.
Yes, exactly. And then I will say another interesting kind of like layer to this that I learned about, I didn't know this until I researched this for the story, is that Ohio businesses can actually pay 14 and 15 year olds the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, which is less than the state's current minimum wage of $10.70 an hour. So businesses can actually pay these teenagers less.
Oh, I wonder if they do. I don't know. All right. Another bill that you wrote about, Megan, is a bill that's named for slain Christian conservative Charlie Kirk. Last week, it cleared the Ohio House, but not without some considerable discussion from both supporters and opponents. Can you tell me, first of all, let's start with, like, what is this bill besides having Charlie Kirk's name?
Yeah, so it has Charlie Kirk's name, so that immediately has been an attention grabber. This bill has moved very quickly. Charlie Kirk, of course, was killed in September, and so then this bill came to fruition after that and is named after him. But basically, it would just allow public schools and public universities to teach the positive impacts of quote-unquote Judeo-Christian religion on American history. This bill originally just talked about the positive impacts of Christian religion, and they broadened it during committee to Judeo-Christian religion. And so basically, it's not... The lawmakers behind the bill are saying this is not a mandate to teach these requirements. It would just add more protections to allow teachers and professors to discuss these impacts in history. And there are several examples that they outline in the bill, such as the history of the Pilgrims, the religious background of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, the rule of the Ten Commandments in quote-unquote shaping America's law. So lots of examples to pull from. So That is what supporters of the bill are advocating for.
Okay, so not other religions, though. Like, we're not talking about the impacts of the Muslim religion or the Buddhist religion or the Jewish religion.
Correct. So that is where there has been, some of the conversations have been. Some folks who are not in favor of the bill have pointed out that exact thing. I was talking with someone last week, and they said that the term Judeo-Christian, they don't like that term. So even some folks have issue with that term. So yes, it's some folks are arguing that this bill is not very inclusive of other religions, and that the United States was founded on religious freedom. So why are we only highlighting certain religions in this bill?
In comments made at the hearing before there was a vote, these were captured from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Ohio College Republican Foundation Chair Gabe Guderini, he said this in support of the bill.
It's not only correct for us to do so, but there's also a moral imperative for us to teach that history and to give that historical context in the classroom.
And then Maxine Irvine, who has two kids in public school in Hilliard, she spoke in opposition to the bill during the hearing.
This is extremely misleading because this bill is Christian nationalism attempting to hide behind more moderate aspects of Christianity.
So, you know, we just heard a comment on each side. Did you listen to the debate, Megan? Did it get pretty heated?
You know, I did not hear that particular debate, but the debate on the House floor for this bill was very back and forth, very ping pong. Like a former teacher, state rep, Sean Brenner, who voted against this bill, he said that history teachers already teach these things that are outlined in the bill in Ohio classrooms. So he was kind of saying, what is the need for this?
All right, what are the next steps here? So you say after a lot of debate, you know, a lot of debate, it got a little heated, but then it did pass the House, right?
Yes, it did pass the House. Yes. And so now we'll move on to the Senate. Again, the Senate is meeting tomorrow, but it'll have to go through the committee process. So this bill likely won't see movement until the new year.
Okay. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. You've been listening to Megan Henry, a reporter at the Ohio Capital Journal. And joining us now, we have Jake Zuckerman, a reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome. Welcome, Jake.
Thank you for having me here. Pardon my punctuality.
That's okay. We are glad you're here now because you're going to talk to us about State Auditor Keith Faber. He released a report last week that gave us some insight into tax credits that the state gives to corporations and whether they're following through on creating promised jobs. So can you tell me a little bit about what we found out here? I'm guessing they're not following through on the promised jobs.
Yeah, well, so these are called job. Well, there are two things. There are job creation tax credits, and then there's some economic development loans, which are just very low interest loans. And the general idea is a company says that we're planning, I think there's a $100 million capital investment requirement. So we're going to invest $100 million here. We're going to create all these jobs. And the state of Ohio says, okay, in exchange for that, we will give you, it's usually about 1% in change of the payroll. So if you're adding, you know, a couple hundred jobs, that's actually a big chunk of change. And we're going to give you that as a tax credit because we want to invest in the creation of new jobs in the state of Ohio. Obviously, these are all front things happening on the front end before the factory is built or whatever have you. And Auditor Faber's office looked into this, and I think there's long been suspicion around these credits of this is too good to be true. You know, these companies come and politicians take pictures and everyone, you know, there's a shovel in the ground or a ribbon being cut. Are we really going to get these jobs? And they looked back and they found that about 2 in 3 of the jobs promised by these companies are not coming to fruition. And in some cases, the companies never get off the ground. In some cases, they provide half, two-thirds, some definitely not all of the jobs they said they're going to make. So, you know, on the one hand, some of these jobs are created in full. Some of these jobs, you know, some of these companies are producing some new jobs. But then the audit asks, so what happens when these companies underperform? And the answer is in only about 40% of the time is the Department of Commerce going back and clawing back or doing anything, I should say.
Like so, penalizing them. Do they penalize them?
Yeah, sometimes there are reductions of the value of the credit. Sometimes there are clawbacks. But those are really rare enforcement actions. The Department of Commerce responded to this audit saying like they wanted to point out that these are quote unquote performance based. So if you say you're going to create 100 jobs and you produce no jobs, you actually don't get any value of the credit because no new payroll has been added. But some of these, like Carvana, for example, produced, I'm fudging the numbers here, but about 60% of the jobs they would for some of their plants around the state. There's no great way to claw back that money. You know, like the value of the credit is contingent on all these new jobs, and companies aren't producing all these new jobs. I asked the Department of Commerce, so what happens if a company produces some but not all of the jobs? Mm. And they declined to answer what they called a hypothetical. I would say it's not a hypothetical. It has been highlighted in this audit, but
yeah,
that, such as quibbling with state agencies. But so I think there's this big problem of, like, in some cases these companies don't seem to be trying or doing anything. In some cases they do seem to be trying but coming up short. So, like, how do you want to invest in that kind of new growth?
I have two examples here. A company called TruePill Inc. created no new jobs, no new payroll, right? But then they wouldn't benefit from having a payroll, like they didn't pay any payroll taxes, right? So they didn't pay 1% less. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And there's an interesting wrinkle with TruePill in that they responded to some of my inquiries and gave a statement to the effect of, we have some concern. They didn't come out and say anything's incorrect, but they said, we're not sure that the data in this audit reflects our most recent filings with the Department of Commerce. So maybe something remains to be seen here, but no one has outright challenged the accuracy of this data.
Okay. And then another example I have is a company that makes Indian snack foods called, I guess it's Sarati.
I don't know the pronunciation.
Yeah. And they made no new jobs. How do they make Indian snack foods here with no people?
I think, well, we're talking no new jobs.
I see.
You know, I'm guessing the company did not respond to my request for comment. You got to assume something happens, like, oh, interest rates go up, so you don't build the plant.
Oh, okay. Maybe so they had said they were going to expand or something, mm-hmm. and they didn't. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be my guess. Again, the company didn't respond to comment. But, you know, the way these sort of announcements come out of the Department of Commerce are like, we have some fantastic news. Sarati, they're going to create 200 new jobs, 100 new jobs. Nobody needs a college degree. Every job pays $130,000. You know, they're just all these really great promises that come out. And I think this audit points out that they are not always met.
Okay. So what did Keith Faber have to say, the auditor? What does he want to have happen?
I think he took I'm going to lay it out for you guys to play it out attitude. Mm. He just said, like, we need to, I think it was in 2021 that the legislature tasked him with, usually the auditor just looks at local governments and, you know, are your finances sound? And in 2021, they tasked the auditor's office with saying, do these investments make sense? Are these companies coming through? And he gave a quote with the audit to the effect of, like, we're putting a lot of value into these companies or, like, into these tax credits, and if they're not producing the jobs they said they would, maybe we should invest that money elsewhere. You know, I mean, the needs are infinite, or the wants are infinite, and every dollar that goes here can't go there.
Megan Henry with your Ohio Capital Journal, you were nodding along as Jake was talking. Do you have anything to add about the audit? Or did Jake cover all the points?
I think Jake covered all the points.
All right. And then the next topic I have, which can be for either of you, is related to property taxes. Lawmakers last month passed a sweeping property tax bill. And I think, Jake, you wrote about recently how landlords will be affected with how lawmakers closed a loophole related to this. What changed for property taxes when it comes to landlords?
Yeah, I mean, my colleague has done, Andrew Tobias has done the yeoman's work on this issue, but the gist of it is the bill takes some of the property tax burden off homeowners who occupy their houses, who live in their homes, and shifts that burden onto owners who do not occupy their homes. So essentially people who are renting their houses. So the net of the whole thing is that homeowners will have less property tax burden, and people who own the rental units will have more of a property tax burden. I think the most likely outcome of that is that burden is going to flow through and people are going to pay more in rents.
They're going to charge more for rent to make up for having to pay more property taxes.
Or maybe the landlords decide to be nice and protect their their tenants. But
Okay, so Megan, these property tax bills, there was like all of these different property tax bills. Did they pass both chambers? Are they waiting for DeWine to sign them? Do you know where we are in the process?
I'm a little unsure. Do you know, Jake?
I believe that one's waiting on DeWine.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay. There's more than one property tax bill, right? Are you only aware of this one at the moment, or?
I would need to look at my list.
Okay. So, but basically, like, Governor DeWine does have a few bills on his desk, but a few property tax bills are some of the ones there. Are we we're waiting on Governor DeWine for the property tax bills. I think we're waiting on Governor DeWine for an election related bill. I think that's on his desk. Do you know, Megan? Is that the
ballot one?
The one with the absentee ballots.
The absentee ballot. Yeah. Yes. Yes. My colleague Nick Evans has been reporting on that quite a bit for us.
The other thing we're waiting for is tomorrow the Senate meets. Can you talk about that? What's happening tomorrow?
Yeah, so tomorrow the Senate will meet and they're scheduled to vote on a bill that it's a massive bill that would change Ohio's marijuana law and also change Ohio's hemp laws and align it with the new federal changes. And so assuming that the Senate will pass that tomorrow, the House already passed it, so then it will go on to Governor DeWine's desk.
Okay, so the House, the Senate, I mean, they've been talking back and forth about marijuana and hemp for a long time. So the Senate passed something, the House took it, and they changed it a little bit, so now the Senate has to come back. Is that what happened?
Kind of, yeah. This bill has been has gone through lots of revisions and changes. The bill actually went to a conference committee, which basically means that there's a small group of lawmakers, some senators, some representatives, both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, who basically came together and were like, let's hash out this bill. And they came up with the most recent bill, which the House passed. And so there was basically a compromise and agreement from both sides of the aisles in both chambers. So this seems like it would be a bill that the Senate would be able to get behind, which previously was the issue that the chambers, the House and the Senate, were not able to agree on a compromise.
So if the Senate passes this tomorrow, it seems like Governor DeWine will sign this one because he's the one that started this all, right, with the hemp? Right.
Essentially, yeah. Mm-hmm. Governor DeWine, for the past almost 2 years now, after the marijuana initiative passed in 2023, has been calling on lawmakers, urging them to do something in regards to the hemp industry in Ohio. Also an added like wrinkle to all this while the Senate bill was going through Ohio's legislature was that in the government shutdown, in the bill that reopened the government was a provision that was kind of added in at the 11th hour that basically would ban hemp
federally.
And so then that kind of threw a wrench into a lot of the work that Ohio lawmakers have tried to do to regulate hemp in Ohio.
Yeah, Ohio had done all this work, and then out of nowhere, the federal government was like, we're reopening the federal government, and oh, by the way, hemp's going to be illegal, but not for a year.
Correct, yeah, there's a year. However, the interesting thing in the Ohio bill, if it were to be signed into law by the end of the year, it would take effect in 3 months, and so that Ohio could actually have an expedited timeline compared to
the federal one. Okay. All right, so this is what the Senate is taking up and expected to pass tomorrow. Jake, do you know, is the Senate going to do anything else tomorrow, or are they all coming back just for this?
No, and I'm told we're going to be in and out tomorrow, which is, from a reporter's point of view, fantastic.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about some higher education bills, and we're going to also talk to some federal changes that could lead to more homelessness. That's when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Megan Henry, a reporter at the Ohio Capital Journal, and we have Jake Zuckerman, a reporter at Signal Ohio. Let's give a quick update on the governor's race in 2026. It's 11 months away. I know that seems like a long time, but I think it'll be here before we know it. Time is long and short at the same time, I feel. The candidates are campaigning. They're drawing headlines. Last week, Dr. Amy Acton picked up endorsements from a large number of public employee unions, the Ohio Civil Service Employees Union, the Ohio Public School Employees, a couple of AFSCME groups. Together, all of these groups represent over 100,000 workers in Ohio. Jake, do you think that these unions were sitting on the sidelines waiting for former Congressman Tim Ryan to decide whether he was jumping in the race or not. And now that's why now they're like, OK, now we'll endorse Dr. Acton.
Well, sure. I mean, I think why lose friends if you don't have to lose friends? Mm-hmm. It's just a pretty basic rule here. I think to me, the most interesting thing that I've taken away is that there's kind of a cleavage happening in the union movement where it's a lot of these more tradesier, for lack of a better word, unions are increasingly endorsing Republican candidates. And then the public sector, you know, the teachers, the government workers, et cetera, are so behind Amy Acton. I don't know if this has always been the case, but it's at least been more pronounced this run.
So, Vivek Ramaswamy is getting endorsements from trade unions. I guess they feel like he's more inclined to create jobs, build more things, something like that.
I think so. And the affiliated construction trades have been a lot more aggressively pushing Republican candidates. They were the first union I really remember sort of going across the aisle and backing candidates financially and otherwise like that. But just some of the local building trades union, I think there was a Northwest Ohio union that had been with Sherrod for a long time and got away from the Democrats. There's just something interesting. I think like it's been very well documented at this point that unions are increasingly seeing their members drift to the right. Some of the Republican Party has softened stance on things like prevailing wage and right to work. It's just kind of interesting watching this drift happen over the last 15 years.
And Megan, what do you make of, Tim Ryan did a whole will he, won't he thing for many, many months, and he kept extending it. What does it mean for Amy Acton's campaign now that Tim Ryan has officially decided he's not running for governor?
Essentially, it just clears the path that she will very likely be the sole Democratic candidate running for governor. So it just kind of clears that path for her and just kind of gives voters a sense of like, hey, it's very, very likely seems to be these two candidates that will be on the ballot for governor next year.
Yeah, I guess the deadline is still not until like February or something. So there could be someone who would jump in at the last minute.
Correct. I would be surprised. I think that's I think all of us would be surprised, but it is possible. But it seems like it's very clearly these two candidates now.
Stranger things have happened, I'm sure. Do you think last week's election in Tennessee, the 7th congressional district, holds any hopes for Democrats in Ohio? The hope out there that Dr. Amy Acton can win and beat Vivek Ramaswamy? Because in that race, a Republican beat a Democrat. But it was by 9 percentage points, and that's a state that Trump won by 22 percentage points. So what the Democrats in Tennessee are saying is they narrowed the margin. So what do you think that means for Democrats here in Ohio in a strong Trump state?
I guess this is the bear take, but personally, I don't care what the losing margin is. I mean, you lost.
You lost.
What is
22% or 9% doesn't matter.
What does your closer than expected run do for anyone?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a thought. Megan, I want to move on to higher education and get an update on how Ohio's colleges are dealing with the new higher ed law known as Senate Bill 1. At Ohio State University, officials took the Senate Bill 1 law to mean that chalking or writing in chalk on university sidewalks should be banned, and they banned it. How else has Ohio State interpreted the law? Has Ohio State University interpreted it more strictly than some other schools?
Yeah, it kind of seems that way. So far, at least, the bill took effect in the Governor DeWine signed this bill into law back in the spring. It took effect over the summer. And so this current fall semester that's winding down across the state is really the first semester that that students and faculty are really feeling the effects of the law, since there's not as many students take summer semester classes. And so, yeah, on the surface, it does seem like Ohio State has been maybe a little more aggressive in interpreting the law than other Ohio public universities, such as the chalking ban you mentioned. They also require that all dorm decor in the common areas must be Ohio State specific. So this is like for residential advisors decorating like the hallway boards, instead of being like, about a show or a movie themed, it has to be Ohio State themed. So that was kind of interesting. But as far as other facets of the law, I've talked to students from various universities, and they were saying how students are feeling kind of a chilling effect in classes. Their professors, they've kind of noticed, are kind of tiptoeing around more controversial topics or not really having these discussions, whereas last year this would be, you know, a ripe for discussion. And professors, too, have said that this just adds more work on their end with, you know, having like their syllabus uploaded and various things. And another facet of this massive law is that the diversity centers, including LGBTQ centers, women's centers, multicultural centers, have all now closed on these university campuses. And so I talked to a student at University of Cincinnati, and he said that when he came back to school in the fall, seeing the African-American Cultural Resource Center be renamed to simply the Cultural Resource, the Cultural Center, was just really, really jarring for him.
Yeah, the basically, you know, students are seeing this law come into effect here and there, but I guess it just depends on how it impacts them. So whenever you're talking about the professors with their classes, what are professors worried about? If a student asks a question that's controversial, are they trying to just like pivot and shut it down rather than having a discussion? Is that what they mean?
Yeah, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially professors who don't have tenure are just worried about, you know, saying something that could get them potentially into trouble. Mm-hmm. Yes.
If a student in that class reports them for having a discussion that is quote-unquote against Senate Bill 1, whatever that means, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay. And have you also written on, there have been some headlines around the state and more recently at Ohio State University about majors being eliminated. That's a requirement of Senate Bill 1, right?
Yeah, essentially it's eliminating majors that have few students graduate in a program. And so Ohio State University last week announced majors that they will be shutting down, essentially, once the current students graduate. So Ohio State is the latest to join several of the public, such as Kent State and Akron, University of Toledo, Ohio University. Mm-hmm. But yes, Ohio State last week announced that in their Board of Trustees meetings. It includes Bachelor of Music and Music Therapy, Associates of Science and Biochemical Science. But essentially that just means that these programs have had very few students graduate in the program.
Is it so it's like fewer than five students over so many years or something like that? I can't remember how the numbers work, but it's just they have very few students. And so that's not going to continue.
Yes, it is programs that graduate fewer than five students on average over the past 3 years.
OK. And so these but if you're in the major right now, so if you're a music therapy major, you can finish your degree. They're just not going to bring in any new ones.
Correct. Yeah, they just won't be accepting anyone new into that program. Hmm.
Well, and I guess the way, you know, if you go to any website for Ohio State University, at the top, there's a line that says, we are working to comply with Senate Bill 1. So, like, every single website says, has, I guess, that caveat that they're still working through it. I mean, this law had a lot to it, right?
Yeah, it's a very massive law. Like I said, this is really the first semester that we've kind of seen it be rolled out. So, I'm sure the lawmakers behind this and state agencies will kind of be looking to make sure that everyone's in compliance. And so there could be more. I mean, likely be more changes to come as a result of this.
Is that caveat just to cover themselves if they have something on their website they're not supposed to? I guess. I don't know.
That would be a safe bet, I think. Yeah.
This is the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking with Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Jake Zuckerman, a reporter at Signal Ohio. Jake, you recently wrote about the storage of millions of gallons of fracking waste and a lawsuit that resulted. And also, the former CEO of Deep Rock Disposal is now the chairman of the Ohio Senate Energy Committee. So there's a lot to unpack there. Can you give us a quick summary on who is suing and why?
Yeah, the lawsuit is coming through the Buckeye Environmental Network, but the plaintiffs are ostensibly some locals based around the Marietta area in southeast Ohio. And the gist of the lawsuit is they are trying to overturn these permits that were granted for, they're called Class 2 injection wells, but really they're deep. They're like 5,000-6,000 feet into the ground. And when you frack a well, you're shooting a bunch of water and sand and chemicals, and you're trying to free natural gas from shale underground and get it all back to the surface, but it leaves you with literal millions of gallons of waste that you got to do something with. Mm-hmm. And so the answer, in Ohio, we have very lax permitting rules around this stuff. So we have 232, which is comparatively a huge amount of these wells. and you just shoot them underwater. And in at least 7 instances over the last decade, ODNR has investigated these complaints and found that brine, the hazardous waste here, is migrating out from these injection wells and reaching oil production wells, which, you know, it ruins the financial asset nature of an oil well, but in the scheme of things, it's probably fine. But the real fear is, okay, so this brine stuff, if we know it's moving for miles underground and getting places it's not supposed to, what about the water aquifer? You know, like, what about these very, very important things? And the city of Marietta, which is probably the most interesting part of the whole story, this very Republican area, these local Republican officials, again, like, not these sort of Democrat environmental lefty types that come to mind, but like really red-blooded Republicans, are pretty outraged. And I think it has a lot to do with how this has been impacting the traditional oil industry. And so they have started this there's a lawsuit coming from the Buckeye Environment Network, and the city of Marietta has actually authorized its city lawyer to initiate a lawsuit. He has not done so yet, but he has plenty of potentiary power to do so. So there's really just this big war going on this very, very lucrative and fairly new industry in Ohio for this waste injection.
So they're suing ODNR for the way that they're getting rid of the wastewater, or?
Yeah, so in 2022, in response to some of these problems, ODNR made much stricter rules for how they change. You have to take literally a wider look from the point of the injection well. Now they have to look 2 miles outward instead of half a mile outward, and they have to do a much more thorough construction analysis, just different sorts of things if your interest is protecting the environment, protecting nearby aquifers especially. And ODNR, despite granting the permit after those new rules took effect, they used the old rules. And in all likelihood, these injection wells would not have passed muster under the stricter new rules. That's the basis of the challenge. And something I should add is the local water authorities are really concerned about this. And I can't remember if they're party to the lawsuit, but they are quoted in the news release. They are very involved in this legal fight against these injection wells.
Is there any evidence of water being contaminated?
No.
Okay.
But there
just,
is
a, it's just a what if
there. Well, yeah, it is just a what if. But I'd add that there's evidence of brine migration. So it is known that brine has left the zone where it is supposed to stay enclosed and stored in very high pressure in these rock formations. So it's getting elsewhere. And I think the big fear here is it's a bell that can't be unrung. Mm. If you have a contamination problem in an aquifer, best case scenario, you're talking about tens of millions of dollars to address it, which that's the best case scenario. You know, I mean, it's water, you know, it is a very base level requirement for human society.
And what's the like sidebar of this, that the former CEO of Deep Rock Disposal is the chairman of the Ohio Senate Energy Committee? What's that sidebar about?
Well, you nailed it. His name is Brian Chavez, and he was appointed to the Ohio Senate in 2024. He and his family run an oil and gas business that includes conventional wells, so sort of old school oil 1900 stuff, and then some of the new unconventional fracking business, including the disposal stuff. So he gets appointed to the Senate. And according to his financial disclosure forms, he resigned from Deep Rock in 2025 at some point, and there's not a whole lot of detail there, so it's unclear, is he involved in this business at all? He's declined my request for interviews and my comments on this stuff. But there's still some indications. There's kind of a complicated legal history here, but he still owns a lot of holdings, he and his wife, in the oil and gas business. His wife, I don't know for sure that she's involved in the business, but she has been appearing at some of these meetings at the Marietta City Council, along with a lawyer that is representing Deep Rock as a company. So I don't want to draw connections that aren't there, but he does seem to be involved with his business. These companies he owns keep popping up in the lawsuits mentioned as owners, or at least at one point having ownership. So he at least has not very clearly explained the distance between he and this company.
Okay, so something to keep an eye on.
Something to keep an eye on.
Megan, we have about 2 minutes left, and one more story that you wrote about is there's a change at the federal level that could impact the number of homeless people in Ohio. Can you tell me what you were hearing from people you interviewed for this story?
Yeah, basically folks are concerned that thousands of Ohioans could re-enter, be at risk of re-entering, experiencing homelessness, essentially due to this change. It basically would change federal funding policy, and it would basically affect permanent supportive housing, rapid rehousing, and traditional housing, among other things. And so housing advocates are just very concerned that this could lead to an influx of people experiencing homelessness, and that the homeless shelters and housing advocates just don't have the capacity to take on all these folks who could reenter homelessness.
So it's a cut in federal money that was going to these rehousing programs or helping subsidize keeping mm-hmm. people in like rental subsidies and stuff like that.
Correct. Yes. It's the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Continuum of Care program, which is the largest federal grant funding source for homelessness service and housing.
Oh, okay. So it's HUD money that was going to local places, mm-hmm. probably like the YWCA, the YMCA here, you know, like different housing agencies, right?
Correct, yes. And advocates are especially worried, obviously, in urban cities, but also the more rural places as well that rely mm-hmm. on these funds.
Okay. So, and each organization is a nonprofit, so if they lose their federal money, they'd have to raise the money to make up for it.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to say thank you for joining us today on the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. You've been listening to Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks for your time today, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks for joining us, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
This has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.